The Tom Woods Show, episode 2242.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am delighted to be able to welcome back Jay Bhattacharya, professor of medicine at Stanford University and the winner of a recent debate at Gene Epstein's Soho Forum, which we all know and love. So, Jay, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be back.
Let's talk about it. I was in New York City not 2 days later. I so wanted to be there in the audience watching this, but through the miracle of technology, I was able to watch it anyway. And I mean, I think it was a very good debate and very civil. Apparently, what's the name of the fellow you debated again?
Dan Vermand. He's a professor at Yale in public health. I think he was head of public health at Yale for a long time.
And apparently you've debated him a couple of times before, so he's a little unusual in that he's, you know, willing to listen to what you have to say and not just dismiss you.
I mean, he is a gentleman, and I'm filled with admiration for him. He's very different from so many other people on the other side of the COVID debate. Even people that I once admired and respected were unwilling to engage with me or other people who criticized the response. Not Sten. Sten debated with me twice before, I think once in 2020 and once in 2021 and now in 2022.
Well, not to mention he actually had the guts to show up at Gene's after party, you know, knowing that a lot of the people in the audience were going to want to pick his brain and criticize his position, whatever. And doggone it, he was there, as were you.
I'm filled with admiration for him. I really enjoyed talking with him. It's one of these things, Tom. I think it's by these kinds of discussions with fair-minded people who disagree with you on things. That's how you learn. That's how science gets done. That's how, you know, basically democracy ought to work. You have to accept that you might be wrong about something and engage with other people. And then as a result, good things happen, I think. A lot of that didn't happen during the pandemic. And so that's why I was so pleased with Sten. I was just delighted that he agreed to do the debate.
Had you two known each other before COVID?
No.
Okay. So you've made a lot of interesting acquaintances and friendships. Because I was thinking, I don't think you knew Martin Kulldorff either.
I knew of his work, but I didn't know him. Now we're like brothers, Tom.
That's crazy. I just love it. And I remember one time I had him on and I did do video. And I just love that wherever he's recording from, he has a mandolin hanging on the wall, you know? I like Martin Kulldorff playing the mandolin. I don't know, something great about that. So let's go into the debate. Maybe you might take a minute or two, if you wouldn't mind, to summarize more or less what the thrust of your argument was.
Yeah. So the topic, as I'm sure your listeners know, was on whether in future pandemics, should we adopt the principles of the Great Barrington Declaration, that is focused protection of the vulnerable, minimizing the disruption of life to the less vulnerable, as the principle for managing a highly infectious respiratory virus pandemic. Now, of course, during this pandemic, that's not what we did. We adopted lockdowns. And so my basic argument is that what's the alternative? Well, there's two alternatives you can think of. You can think of the lockdown policies we actually did, right? Mass quarantining of healthy populations, shelter-in-place orders, propagandas to spread fear and panic so that everyone thinks they're all in it together, censorship, deplatforming of dissenting voices, closed schools, businesses, places of religious worship, masks. The basic idea of lockdown is that we make sure the population thinks that everybody else is a biohazard, that every single other human you meet is a biohazard. That's one possibility. The other possibility is to let it rip. Just ignore the fact that there's a pandemic, vulnerable and non-vulnerable alike get exposed to the virus or the pathogen or whatever it is. Assuming that you can't like stop it and it's, you know, like you find out where the thing leaked from and then suppress it immediately right there, then you don't have to worry about either of these options. But imagine it's already spread out like it already had by, say, April of 2020 or March of 2020. There you have just three options: lockdown, let it rip, or focus protection, the GBD. The GBD was the normal way we deal with respiratory virus pandemics. For a century, that's what we've done. In 1957, 68, 76, 2003, 2009, although 2003, the SARS-1, it sort of petered out before we really needed it. But in any case, it was focused protection in the places where it was spread. You know, Woodstock was held during the 1968 pandemic. I mean, think about that. So this is how we manage respiratory virus pandemics until COVID. In COVID, we adopted this novel idea of a lockdown, and it failed. It utterly failed. And you can understand why it failed, because it essentially is a strategy that protects only a certain class of people who can afford to lock down without losing their jobs. I mean, I call it trickle-down epidemiology, Tom, which I'm sure you like.
I like that phrase, yeah.
Because the idea is like, okay, we protect the laptop class and everyone else is protected by sort of osmosis. Well, that's not true. In fact, most people around the world can't abide a lockdown. They have to work to feed their families. The harm to poor countries by the lockdowns are tremendous. You know, we talked about broken supply chains. Well, the pointy end of that is somebody living in a poor country, barely making a living to feed his family. He's thrown out of work and now he makes less than $2 a day of income. His children starve. 100 million people thrown into poverty, tens of million people into dire food insecurity. In March of 2021, the UN estimated that there were 238,000 children that died of starvation and other disruptions in South Asia alone as a consequence of the COVID lockdown disruptions. Domestically, we have these health problems because of skipped screening for cancer, worsening mental health, you know, obviously the recession. And our kids, we close schools with tremendous learning loss, and it's incredibly unequal. It's really, it's poor kids that suffered the worst, minority kids that suffered the worst. This is the biggest driver of generational inequality based on a single policy we've ever adopted. So lockdown failed because it didn't take into account the living circumstances of the vast majority of the world's population who could not abide a lockdown. So that was the setup. I talked a little bit in the thing about the immunity as an endpoint. Of course, you have to have immunity as an endpoint. This isn't HIV. After people get COVID, they recover, they have substantial protection against subsequent infection until there's a new variant, and also against severe disease. A lot of people got confused about this. They're saying, okay, well, herd immunity just means everyone has had the vaccine, and that means the disease will stop spreading. The endpoint, either with the vaccine or with COVID recovery, isn't elimination of the virus. The virus is going to circulate forever, right? There's no technology we have to get rid of the virus. What we have is now, compared to 2020, a very large fraction of the population COVID recovered, a large fraction of the population vaccinated, in many cases both. And as a result, we have decoupled cases from deaths. Per case, there are many, many fewer deaths. So what is focused protection for? It's to buy time to protect the vulnerable people until a technology is developed to treat the virus, to treat people who have the virus, a vaccine maybe, whatever it is. It's a temporary measure to protect the most vulnerable people, you know, in this case, elderly people, which we knew almost very early on in the pandemic. And then for the rest of the population to not disrupt their lives so that we don't harm them as we did during the lockdowns.
Now, that all makes perfectly good sense. It's interesting to me, though, that although Stan is a good sport to be willing to discuss these sorts of things, the big tech platforms have not been a safe place to have this conversation. Sometimes you can talk about lockdowns. They're very sensitive about masks. Can't really criticize masks that sharply or they'll come down on you, particularly YouTube. Lockdown has been a little bit here and there, whether you're really allowed to talk about it. So I'm going to roll the dice and put this episode on YouTube. I normally just, you know, I put them all on YouTube, even though there's no video, because why not? But I wonder at what point, I'm sorry to divert the conversation a bit, but given that you could see somebody making the case that while it's going on, given that some people believe that lockdowns were the only way to prevent mass death, they would justify banning discussion of them on the grounds that we can't undermine people's confidence in these public health measures because they're the only thing standing between us and unthinkable catastrophe. But here it is, 2.5 years later, and I still wonder if I'm allowed to talk about, is there ever going to be a time, like in 50 years, are we allowed to say, you know, 50 years ago, maybe we did the wrong thing? I don't even know when this happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Tom, the thing is, okay, so public health, there's an ethics to what discussions like professionals are supposed to do when they talk about public health topics, right? So if I, for instance, get up, I'm a Stanford professor in the School of Medicine, I get up and say, Tom, you know, smoking is good for you. I mean, that is a public health crime, right? I really shouldn't say that. It's a deeply irresponsible thing to say, especially for someone who has some authority that should know better. And so like, if I were to get up and say that, you would be right to say to me, Jay, you really shouldn't do that. It's a violation of your authority vested in you and your position as a professor in the School of Medicine at Stanford. And I would agree with you. And that is because there's a deep evidence base that shows convincingly beyond any doubt that smoking is terrible for you. It causes cancer. It causes heart disease. It is just a bad thing for you to do. Now, the moral basis for restrictions in speech in that case is the true consensus that the scientific community has reached on this on the basis of real evidence. Now, if I come up with something that says, like, let's say there's a ban in smoking 15 feet away from any public building, and I do a research thing that says, look, that doesn't seem to have too big effect on smoking rates. Well, I should be allowed to say that, right? That's my finding. It's true. That is, I think, permissible, even though smoking is bad for you. I can say this smoking ban doesn't work to address smoking. Now let's go to COVID. In the context of COVID, we have a new virus come on the scene. There's tremendous scientific uncertainty about every single aspect of this. How contagious is it? How does it spread? Who is most vulnerable? Although that was actually clear by January 2020, certainly. What's the best way to treat it? 100 things, 1,000 things, you don't have the answer to. And in that setting, you have to let science work. Science works by letting people speak to each other. Even regular people grappling with scientific questions is actually quite a good thing because new hypotheses come up. Things get tested. It's not just a matter for professionals to talk to each other. And to suppress speech in that context is a deeply unethical thing to do, which is exactly what happened during the pandemic. Because what we had is people like Tony Fauci and others take on the mantle of the science as if just because they are experts, they know the answers to scientific questions just by osmosis or something. That's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. There's nobody alive that has access to that kind of godlike knowledge. The only way to get true things out of science is to let science proceed, which is messy, requires people to disagree with each other publicly, and then to do tests and then argue over the interpretations of those experiments. And to suppress speech about that essentially suppresses scientific progress altogether. And that's, I think, exactly what we've seen during the pandemic. Public health applied its smoking is bad for you ethic to a situation where the moral basis of that ethic did not hold because there was uncertainty. There was lack of consensus about 1,000 questions on COVID. Instead, it adopted this mantle, this illusion that there was a consensus and said, no, Tom, you can't speak on YouTube. No, Jay, you can't post that on Twitter. Whatever you say, your thoughts are so dangerous, you can't speak because you're violating the consensus. Even though there never actually was one, it's too new a disease to credibly claim that any consensus ever existed on so many of these topics.
Let me raise something from the debate that I found interesting. It wasn't just a debate on were lockdowns a good idea. It was also a debate that went into some detail about what focus protection might look like in particular circumstances. And one of Sten's arguments was that the Great Barrington Declaration was just much too short. We need to get a lot of specifics about exactly what focus protection would look like. And one of your points was, this is something because of differing circumstances that has to be worked out at the local level by people familiar with local conditions. So as we look to the future, if we want to think about what focus protection might look like in a future situation like this, we should be thinking about that now on the local level. But I guess my question to you would be, we can't know in advance if in the future we face some other previously unknown disease, that it's going to have the same kind of, for example, age gradient we saw here, 1,000-fold difference in mortality between old and young. Maybe it won't have that demographic difference. And so then if we were planning for COVID again, that would be one thing. It's like the U.S. government trying to go after the shoe bomber by after the shoe bomber, we all take our shoes off. Okay, but so there won't be another shoe bomber. You know, so how do local officials prepare for something they can't entirely predict?
I mean, I think you have to be flexible, right? So we didn't know there was going to be this age gradient, but it was really clear from the Chinese data and from the Diamond Princess cruise data very early in the pandemic that there was this age gradient. So what you need is a public health that's flexible around this. You need scientific work to be done very rapidly and on the basis of maybe sometimes incomplete information, identify who's most vulnerable. It may be there's a virus or pathogen that floats around that's most dangerous to children. That was true for polio, for instance. And so then you'll have to have a very different set of policies, but the principle is the same, focus protection. And it's also going to be the same that it's going to fall on local public health who understands the living circumstances of the people that they're supposed to take care of better than people sitting on high in Washington or Geneva or wherever. So I think the key thing is there's not a formula, there's just a principle. So you have to have local public health trained to understand those living circumstances so that if it turns out, for instance, it's children, they can then design policies to protect those kids who are then in this hypothetical disease most vulnerable. It's never going to be a formulaic where you can just turn the crank. It's going to take creativity, something that I think public health officials have really sorely lacked during the pandemic.
There's a point that I keep making, and I think it's a pretty darn good one, which is, it's a hypothetical, but imagine we could go back in a time machine and ask people in, when I say people, I mean ask lockdown enthusiasts in April 2020, suppose you have an American state that does the following, and then we just more or less describe what Florida wound up doing starting later that year. What do you think the outcome would look like? I think it's not even debatable that the answer would have been, well, absolutely catastrophic, of course. I mean, it would be maybe an order of magnitude worse than any other state. We would be hearing all these gruesome predictions as to what would happen. Well, then we actually have the case of Florida, and the result was not gruesome, especially when you correct for age. And yet they're still criticizing Ron DeSantis, but yet not one of them would have predicted that Florida would actually have had such an obviously, you know, at worst it was average. At worst it was average outcome. So I don't even see how any of them can deny that. If I had asked you in April 2020, what would happen if we don't follow these public health recommendations, you would have told me absolute catastrophe. But then Florida didn't have absolute catastrophe. The best they can come up with is, well, Florida's slightly worse than a few other states. Look, in April 2020, you would not have said to me, if Florida doesn't do these things, it'll wind up slightly worse. You would not have said that in 2020. So if that's the best they can come up with in 2022, is that maybe by some measures, if you don't correct for age or something, Florida's slightly worse, even that is a victory because not one of them would have had such a sanguine prediction in April 2020.
Well, actually, in April 2020, I actually went on TV and called for focus protection.
Good for you. Of course you did.
But you're absolutely right, Tom. The spirit of your comment is right. Like, it's not as if we don't have variation in the real world in terms of the policies adopted. No place did perfect focus protection. Even Sweden, early in the pandemic, they sent COVID-infected patients to Stockholm nursing homes. It was a disaster.
Yeah.
The opposite of focus protection. But very broadly speaking, the places that did not adopt draconian lockdown policies, that did not try to divide the population, into clean and unclean or spread panic and fear, the places that tried to have a more measured response, I mean, I'd even say more. Sweden did better than most of Europe in terms of overall excess deaths. Florida did, if you look at overall all-cause excess mortality during the pandemic, and you compare Florida and California, Florida's had lower all-cause excess mortality during the pandemic. And, in terms of age-adjusted mortality from COVID itself, it's pretty close to the average, as you say, probably, I think, slightly better than average.
Yeah.
And at the same time, Florida kids got to go to school. Florida businesses didn't close. The working class wasn't destroyed the way it was in California. All these markers of successes without the corresponding harms, I don't see how anyone can honestly look at the results of the pandemic led by people who pushed the lockdowns and successfully got their way and say, well, look, it worked. It very clearly didn't. And I think a lot of times, I think what's happening is the reason why people are jumping and saying this is because a lot of people were in favor of it before. It's like the Iraq War. A lot of people were in favor of the Iraq War in 2003. And by 2006, everyone had forgotten that they were in favor of it.
Right, right. Yeah, I was wondering if this would turn out to be one of those things. I think it is still kind of... Well, one thing that everybody wants to pretend they didn't favor was shutting down the schools. Right? I mean, Randy Weingarten is claiming that she was fighting to keep them open. You know? I mean, we all know that's not right. And Gretchen Whitmer trying to tell everybody that they closed them for only 3 months. That's nuts. Apparently, the focus groups must really, really dislike the school closures because that's what they've really, really tried to pretend didn't happen. Hey, folks, quick sponsor message via Woods here. Let me tell you something. With Christmas coming, there are a lot of gifts you can get people that they're absolutely going to hate. But there are fantastic and unique gifts that nobody else is going to get them that they're going to love. Why not get one of those? And an excellent, excellent gift idea this Christmas is a big old box of Omaha steaks. The Woodses have been eating Omaha steaks for well over a dozen years. We love the convenience, the value, and the quality. Absolutely delicious, and what a great gift idea. The steak experts at Omaha Steaks have put together special curated gift packages that will help make you a Christmas hero. So go to omahasteaks.com and use code WOODS at checkout to get $30 off your order. Send an assortment of mouth-watering favorites guaranteed to impress, like the legendary Butcher's Cut Filet Mignon, air-chilled boneless chicken, ultra-juicy burgers. The burgers are ultra-juicy, and even easy-to-prepare comfort meals that are ready in a flash. Omaha Steaks is ready to ship your order right away, so shop early and beat the shipping rush. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code WOODS at checkout to get that extra $30 off your order. Minimum order may be required. Can I shift gears a little bit? Because it's been so long since we've spoken that I think the last time we'd spoken, the email between, I think, Fauci and Francis Collins, and maybe some others, hadn't yet come out, or we weren't aware of it, that early on, after you and your colleagues wrote the Great Barrington Declaration, that Dr. Fauci was saying that, I don't know if it was Fauci or Collins, but something like, this needs to be smashed. Or I mean, it was some, I don't remember the exact language, but obviously you know the nature of the email. What were they saying, and who was it?
So yeah, so it was Francis Collins, the head of the NIH. He wrote to Tony Fauci 4 days after we wrote the Great Barrington Declaration. The Great Barrington Declaration, we wrote, me, Martin Kulldorff, and Sunetra Gupta, we wrote that in October 4th, 2020. And we put it online and, you know, tens of thousands of people signed it. I mean, now almost a million people have signed it, regular people, doctors, epidemiologists, tens of thousands of doctors. It sort of went viral really fast on October 4th, 2020. On October 8th, 2020, Francis Collins wrote an email to Tony Fauci calling the three of us, the main authors of it, fringe epidemiologists. I mean, someone made a business card for me that says fringe epidemiology on it, Tom.
I love that. I would give that out to people. I love that.
It's fantastic. I got to put it on my epitaph, you know, when I die. and then he called for a devastating published takedown of the premises of the Great Barrington Declaration.
That's what it was. That's what it was. Devastating public takedown. But instead, we didn't really get that. It was instead a devastating silence for the most part. Well, or mischaracterization.
I started getting calls from, like, you know, New York Times reporters asking me why I want to let the virus rip. We're calling for folks' protection of vulnerable older people. How is that letting the virus rip? Tony Fauci gets on TV and accuses us of wanting to let the virus rip, says we're spouting nonsense. Way to understand what was happening there was that we had exposed the idea that Tony Fauci and Francis Collins were truly representing a almost universal consensus of scientists and epidemiologists about what to do about the pandemic. I mean, Stanford, Harvard, Oxford, we had essentially showed that there wasn't a scientific consensus. There was actually quite a bit of unease with the lockdowns. We had shattered this illusion of consensus that Collins and Fauci wanted to create. That's why they just abused their power to try to smash us. They were quite concerned that our ideas were going to take root and that people would no longer think that Tony Fauci himself was the science, that there was actually more to science than Tony Fauci himself. And actually, it's worth understanding who Francis Collins is and what his role is. He sits on top of $45 billion of federal money that goes to almost every single biomedical scientist of note in the United States. And I'm a professor in the medical school at Stanford. I don't get tenure if I don't get NIH funding. You have to get it in order to show that you've actually arrived, that you're a competent scientist. So he doesn't just control the ability to do science, Tom. He also controls the social standing of scientists, promotion decisions, salary decisions, where you are in the pecking order. Your ability to convince other scientists depends on decisions that the NIH makes. So when the head of the NIH comes out and says, these people are fringe, there should be a devastating takedown, scientists take note and they stay silent. A lot of people censored themselves because they saw the treatment that people who signed the great and wrote the Great Barrington Declaration got, which is, you know, quite difficult. I mean, some people actually lost their jobs for signing the Great Barrington Declaration.
That's absolutely insane. I had known about the money. I had no idea that you had to get NIH funding to be considered for tenure because of what it symbolizes. And so what that means that he holds in his hands the futures of young scientists and therefore influences, even if only sometimes in a subtle way, the avenues of research they pursue and the conclusions they want to state publicly. That's very disturbing for me as a layman to hear. Are you able to say something about the lawsuit that the Attorney General of Missouri and I think also in Louisiana is pushing that I believe you are a party to?
Yeah, so I'm a party to that lawsuit. Yeah, so it was brought by the Louisiana and Missouri Attorney Generals. The Missouri Attorney General, he was just elected to the Senate, the U.S. Senate. The lawsuit alleges that the Biden administration directed a massive censorship regime, effectively telling social media outlets both what to censor, what ideas to censor, and in some cases, who to censor on a very wide variety of topics, but certainly including on COVID. And what we found so far from discovery is that there are at least 12 agencies within the federal government, including the Department of Homeland Security, the NIH, even the Census Bureau, that were in regular communication with social media outlets, Twitter, Facebook, Google, you name it, telling them which ideas they wanted censored and in some cases, who they wanted censored. It's interesting to read these emails because it looks like the social media companies were quite happy to go along in many cases with this. But, you know, there's a power imbalance there. The government comes to you and says, you know, it'd be really, really terrible if you were to allow this speech to happen. That's a nice platform you got going there. It'd be a shame if something were to happen to it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the implicit thing going on, that you cannot have government directing speech in this way. It is a gross violation of American First Amendment rights. And it happened just routinely as if it were the most normal thing. This lawsuit exposes this censorship regime. It is, in effect, Tom, is that Ministry of Truth that we were all worried about, that disinformation board that got dismantled. Well, it turns out it wasn't dismantled. It was there all along, only much more broadly than just that one disinformation governance board that got taken down.
Well, of course, we all would recognize if the federal government did these things directly, that it's violating the First Amendment. So it seems to think that it can operate in secret and secretly urge private actors to do these things, that then somehow it can evade the First Amendment restriction. But that just seems like it's simply delegating to a private party a power that it does not have in the first place. So you would think this is a slam dunk for you guys.
I'm not a lawyer, Tom, but like from what I understand, the government really can't do this. They can't like offload their censorship regime to some other people and then pretend like they had no role in it. Of course they had a role in it. I think the extent of censorship that we've seen during the pandemic is, I mean, certainly in my lifetime, I've never seen the like. I think you have to go back 100 years to World War I to start to see anything like this in the United States, the censorship regime, or maybe even back to the Alien and Sedition Acts. But what you have is a violation, a direct violation of the letter of the First Amendment. But if not that, certainly a violation of the spirit of the First Amendment that requires the government of the United States to let speech happen very broadly. And if you're going to interfere in speech, there better be a good reason, you know, crying fire in a crowded theater. This is not that. This is just the government using its power to suppress speech on vital health policy topics. Again, taking on itself this like mantle of we know the science, even though the science is being hashed out in real time by the government. So I think if the courts don't repudiate this, admonish the federal government, I mean, I really think that the government will use this power over and over again, not just in pandemic settings and other settings. And the First Amendment will be effectively a dead letter.
Let's wrap up with this. You have a very cool, calm, and collected demeanor, even in debates. And I remember, I think I've said this to you once before, and you reproached yourself because there was one online debate where you feel like you lost your temper for 15 seconds or something. But you know what I'm talking about. You're very reserved, but you let the arguments do the talking. You know, you want to generate more light than heat, and that's a wonderful thing. But despite this aspect of your personality, which is unchanged, it seems to me, though, that the Jay Bhattacharya of late 2022 is a somewhat different man from the Jay Bhattacharya of early 2020 in perhaps a number of ways, one of which is I would venture to guess that in early 2020, you know, maybe if somebody had raised the issue of the influence that a Francis Collins has with all that money at his disposal, you might have said, yeah, you know, that's concerning and there can be problems leading to that. But I don't think you would have realized or thought about just how severe the problems arising from that situation can be. So I feel like today there are issues that weren't even on your radar screen a few years ago that now are deeply concerning to you. So am I right about this? That now maybe you feel deeply alienated from fellow academics in ways you didn't nearly 3 years ago. Can you maybe say a word about this?
I mean, I think both are true. My eyes are opened in many ways. I mean, I was very naive then. I mean, it's not that I didn't understand that someone like Francis Collins or Tony Fauci had tremendous power. It's that I didn't fully appreciate Lord Acton's admonition that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. What you have is a deep abuse of power that I didn't think these people I once admired were capable of. I mean, I looked up to Francis Collins. I have a textbook on my bookshelf on internal medicine that Tony Fauci was an editor of that I read when I was a medical student. If I look back at myself, I was incredibly naive, Tom. I thought that there were people of goodwill in these positions, obviously not omnipotent, but that were seeking truth and wanting to engage with others so that they could find truth. I thought that if I spoke up and offered evidence, we could have a conversation. Maybe they changed their minds about things. I look back now and I really was naive about that. There was essentially panic, abuse of power in a way that I didn't think possible in the scientific community. And I kind of now want to work toward reform of science and the structures of the scientific bureaucracies so that these kinds of abuses of power don't happen again. I mean, the old lesson is you have to have checks and balances. Turns out most of those checks and balances didn't exist or fail during the pandemic. So we have to reform our system so that people don't have this kind of power that can be abused to the harm of so many.
There's such an important distinction to be made between science in the abstract and science as it's actually carried out by real flesh and blood human beings and our flawed institutions. And I think somebody like Dr. Fauci has been trying to conflate these two things, that the scientific establishment in the U.S. is science, but it's a slew of conflicts of interests and intimidation tactics and self-censorship. And what I mean, it's not the glamorous, impartial pursuit of truth that Francis Bacon described to us centuries ago.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. That's how my eyes have been opened. Science is done by humans. I mean, in that sense, Tom, it's both better and worse than we've been talking about. It is a human activity with human strengths and human foibles. And because it's human, no one can claim godlike omnipotence or omniscience, rather, like Tony Fauci did when he says, if you criticize me, you're not simply criticizing a man, you're criticizing science itself. Like, think of the hubris of that. No one can actually unironically say that, but yet Tony Fauci did. So on the one hand, something that ought to be a humble thing, humble yet powerful, a process by which we can come together to learn about the material world, learn what makes it tick, use that knowledge to better our health, our material well-being, our livelihoods. That's on the one hand, right? This human thing where we talk to each other and learn from each other, sometimes argue vociferously with each other. On the other hand, you have this idea of science of a few high priests, the scientific clerisy, who know how we should live, who know the difference between true and false unerringly, and then can use that their knowledge and power to expel heretics, to conduct devastating takedowns of all the fringe figures out there so that their truth can obtain. I mean, those are the choices, right? Maybe I'm being too dramatic, but I think if we don't reject the latter, which is what we've had during the pandemic, we're going to get more of the same of it.
Yeah, and that was a very stirring conclusion to your debate, which I'll use to wrap this up at long last. You said at the end that we should be thinking about the future. And if we don't commit expressly never to lock down again, then there's no assurance that we won't. And even if we do commit, there's still no assurance that somebody won't still impose it on us. But what you've done is so important. Have you, I know there's a whole bunch of books written on this. I wrote a book on the 2008 financial crisis a long time ago that came out in early 2009. And when I wrote it, I knew that the whole world was going to write books on this. So the only advantage I would have was being the first one. So I killed myself to get that thing out there. And it did very, very well. It did very well. But indeed, a good number of books were written about it. But that doesn't make me feel like my book wasn't worthwhile because I have a particular perspective that I think is missing from many of the other books. Well, likewise, we know, you know, Scott Atlas has a book and I have interviewed him about that. And there are a lot of people who observe this close up who've written books on it. Do you know where I'm going with this? Have you ever considered that?
I have, Tom. So I mean, the last 2.5 years I've been so busy with, I've lost podcasts and op-eds and scientific articles I've written. I mean, it's just been exhausting. I have not had the bandwidth to think about writing a book, but I absolutely want to write one just for my own mental health, actually. I had a front row seat in so many of the policy discussions and debates that have happened. I mean, I've had the absolute privilege of being able to talk to presidents, governors, prime ministers, religious figures. It's been absolutely humbling. And I think people will be interested to hear, at least I hope they will. But even if they don't, Tom, I just need to write it because I've lost friendships. I've made deep new friendships. I've learned a lot about the way the world actually works. And I've learned a lot about science and COVID also. I think it's just to come to terms with that and process it, I need to write something, some memoir-y thing maybe. It seems a little self-indulgent, frankly, but that's
I would absolutely love to read it. And not to mention in this electronic age, when you write a book, it's probably forever. I mean, people will be able to access it so that when historians or just curious people in the future look back on this period, they'll know that there was more than one way of looking at this and that there was a very, very persuasive argument against the various things that were done that, for all we know, in the textbooks, we'll get all the credit for our advances against COVID. You know, they'll get the credit for it. We need to have a Jay Bhattacharya with his experiences giving his testimony. So I hope that does happen sometime in the relatively near future. People should follow you on Twitter for sure. I'm going to put your Twitter handle up. I think it's Dr., like Dr. and then Jay, then Bhattacharya. But that's a lot to ask of people. So I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/2242. And of course, if you had a book, I'd try to sell copies of it for you, but I don't know what else I can do for you. Like, you're doing things for me. What can I do for you?
Tom, I really enjoy that we're now friends. This is one of these things where, like, I've met so many interesting people, but for the pandemic, we wouldn't have been. I wouldn't have ever gotten to know you, I don't think.
Probably not. It's the same thing. I agree.
Maybe it doesn't make up for all of the harms that I've done to people, but it is one of the small blessings. Like, I've got to know so many interesting people like you, and I hope to be able to keep those relationships up.
Yes, absolutely, 100% agreed. I've thought this about the people all over the world I've gotten to know through this. I wish I could meet someday, and in my international travels, one at a time, I intend to do just that. Well, again, I appreciate your time. I think I tried to wrap this up 3 times because I feel bad keeping you this long. But thanks so much again. Congratulations on winning that debate. I'll also link on the show notes page to the video of the debate for anybody who'd like to watch it. So thanks again, Jay.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Black Friday weekend is here, and that means you get the best deal of the year at libertyclassroom.com. This is my parallel institution. I can't fix the history department at Yale University, but I can create something that'll reach a heck of a lot more people. And that's libertyclassroom.com, where you learn the real history, the real economics, the stuff they didn't tell you, the stuff they kept from you, the stuff they distorted. It's all fixed. It's all there for you to learn on the go while you're driving your car or sitting at home at 3 o'clock in the morning, anytime on demand for you. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.